welcome to the Joint Angel Pool and Angel Capital Association conference call. This is Michael Price of CEO Ventures. I serve as the 2011 volunteer chair of angelpool.org, and I'll be moderating today's call. We have an excellent speaker on angel capital best practices today, Chris Dixon, co-founder of Founders Collective. Before we begin, just some quick housekeeping announcements. Everyone is currently in mute. A number of questions were submitted in advance that we'll work our way through, but if you have any burning questions during the first part, once the speaker has finished with the remarks, I will signal you to press star 6 to unmute your mic and go ahead and ask your questions. Just please remember to press star 6 again after asking your question so that the background noise does not get out of hand. After the speaker remarks, I'll then remind everyone how to unmute their phones to ask questions again. For those joining the call for the very first time, both AngelPool.org and the Angel Capital Association are organizations of volunteer leaders who help angel groups across North America and are dedicated to helping their leadership build strong angel groups in their cities to drive jobs, innovation, and exciting new companies. For those angel groups that need additional capital to complete a seed round or that would like access to more deal flow, the Angel Pool Syndication Network is now the world's largest, providing easy monthly access to a large number of other angel groups and deals within their region. This also provides the members of each angel group total visibility into all the best deals in their region. AngelPool.org also organizes knowledge and educational events like this one to share best practices and lift each other's angel skills and knowledge. The Angel Capital Association provides in-person syndication meetings at both the regional and national levels, which is also highly valuable, along with exceptional training, courses, conferences, and many other key functions, such as serving as a public policy voice of the angel community. At the tail end of this call, we'll be updating everyone on the upcoming ACA conference dates to include the annual conference coming in March, which will be in Austin this year. This ensures each angel group and their angels better fulfill their missions of helping entrepreneurs be more successful, so their portfolios in turn will also be more successful. With that, let's go ahead and begin. Today's speaker again is Chris Dixon, co-founder of Founders Collective. He'll be speaking on the topic of partnering with entrepreneurs, team building, product development, and financing. As quick background, Chris is a co-founder of Founder Collective, a seed stage venture capital fund built by a collection of successful entrepreneurs. Founder Collective is headquartered in New York City and Cambridge, makes investments all over the world, is industry agnostic, and has an exceptional realized IRR in over 110 angel investments. Before Founder Collective, Chris worked at Bessemer Venture Partners making early-stage investments, including the lead investment in the Series A of Skype. He has designed and programmed multimedia web apps and also has served as co-head of R&D at Arbitrade. Some of Chris's investments, in addition to being an early investor in Skype, include Foursquare, Docverse, which was acquired by Google, Invite Media, also acquired by Google, Site Advisor, acquired by McAfee, KSolo, acquired by News Corp, Arbitrade, acquired by Citigroup, and many others. He also hosts the TechCrunch Founder Interview Series, which I personally enjoy, and co-founded Huddle in all of his spare time. He has not been idle. With that, Chris, all yours.
Okay, thank you very much for having me. Just a little bit more of my background briefly. So I'm originally from Ohio, and I moved to New York, and I was a computer programmer. And then I worked briefly at Bessemer Venture Partners, which you're probably familiar with, it's a large venture capital firm, and left there actually, it wasn't an investor, but actually co-founded and was CEO of a company called Site Advisor, which was an internet security company we started in 2004, and then that company, we were acquired by McAfee in 2006, and I became at that point a pretty active personal angel investor, then I eventually left a company called Hunch, where I still am today as a co-founder and CEO, and simultaneously co-founded a seed venture fund called Founder Collective. I'll talk mostly here, even though I've sort of been an entrepreneur for most of the last decade, angel investing is sort of a side activity for me. I'll be talking mostly about that because that's what many people are interested in. When I started my first few angel investments I did personally, I learned a few lessons pretty quickly. One of them was that some of the most interesting companies I wanted to invest in were companies that people wanted to invest in were over to try and very hard to get into them. And learned pretty quickly that one of the key skills in the to being a good angel investor would be not just finding good companies, but getting access to them. And so I spend a lot of time sort of trying to build a reputation as a helpful angel investor in order to get into good deals. When I was investing personally, I started noticing these, this is sort of 2006-07, I started noticing these sort of funny trends where we would, for example, syndicated angels would do, we'd put together a seed round, and then the companies go out to, you know, generally the companies we fund will go and later on raise venture capital from larger VCs. We started noticing these trends that the bigger VCs, because I think, because you had sort of these two broad macro trends, which is one that a lot of VC firms have gotten bigger and bigger. And so, you know, for example, Benchmark, I think, was a $100 million fund in the 90s, and now it's like a $500 million fund, something like that. Like, all the funds have gotten much bigger, having to do, I think, with the fee structure of the funds. And simultaneously, a lot of the companies we're investing in, particularly internet companies, require less and less capital. And so we find ourselves in situations where we would invest in a company early stage, and then they would go out to raise a Series A, and we'd actually see VCs offering higher pre-money valuations in order to put more money into the company because they were much more concerned with sort of absolute dollar returns because of the size of their funds. And so, as I would describe it, when you see a market where the buyer is arguing for a higher price, something is probably wrong with that market. And we thought what was wrong with the market was just simply the fact that there were these sort of large funds which weren't, simply weren't structured to sort of fit with the amount of capital required for a lot of these companies, particularly these internet companies. And so this was part of the impetus behind Founder Collective. I think that was one thesis. Another thesis we had was that the East Coast, and particularly New York, was becoming an interesting area for technology investing. In 2007 or 8 or something, we sort of saw more and more of this happening. You don't need a sort of hardcore CS background today to start an interesting company because so much of the kind of technology stack is already available to you through like Amazon Web Services and things like this. And so people with kind of product and design skills would be starting really interesting companies, and that really lent itself to sort of the strength of the New York talent pool. And then finally, we thought it would be interesting to have a kind of a seed venture firm that was composed exclusively of people who were entrepreneurs, either throughout their careers, sort of serial entrepreneurs, because we thought that kind of gave us a different angle where we can complement kind of traditional venture investors. So we often will do investments, along with more financial types. And we think that kind of gives it, our things that we're able to bring kind of complement what maybe traditional, angels / seed / venture firms bring. So that's kind of the thesis behind it. And we started the fund. It's a $50 million fund. A lot of that money, more than half of it, is our own or entrepreneurs who are friends of ours. We have made about 80 investments. And then I also have about 15 personal investments. We try to invest, we try to get first money into a company, really kind of true seed investing. We don't do follow-on, we don't even do pro rata follow-on investing because we want to have our incentives completely aligned with the entrepreneurs. And we really try to get it involved at the earliest stages it tends to be, often we're investing before there's even as really a product. And a lot of the work we do is around helping put together the founding team, think about kind of product strategy, and then really I think probably the most valuable thing we try to do is help, once the company's made progress and sort of hit certain key milestones, help them raise follow-on financing from kind of traditional VCs, which is a process that we've gone through both as entrepreneurs many times and also as investors sort of advising companies. We sort of think that the combination of the fact that we have a lot of investments and we're sort of seeing a lot of market data, kind of knowing which VCs are interested in which areas, where are the valuations and what terms are things like that give us kind of an advantage there. you know, by being in touch with a lot of different companies, we were able to see kind of trends. We sort of read what best practices, you know, what's working on the marketing side, what's working on the, you know, the product side. We keep, you know, careful track of sort of the interesting, let's say, you know, developers and other kinds of people that are around so that we can help when recruiting comes. We try to have a pretty good network on the East Coast, particularly, which, you know, we invest both in the East Coast and the West Coast. We're all over anywhere, really anywhere, but they tend to fall mostly in New York and California, and we find that helps us, you know, when our friends, like sort of other angel investment groups are investing on the West Coast, we think they often will hopefully see us as a value-added, you know, addition to the syndicate because we have kind of an East Coast focus. I think some of the most interesting stuff that I get involved with personally is around follow-on financing. I try to help a lot with, you know, having worked in D.C. and having raised money many times as an entrepreneur. I don't know, I probably pitched D.C.'s myself hundreds of times, kind of learning sort of, you know, some of the best practices there and helping people. I think, like, you know, I'll give you some examples. I think a common mistake that entrepreneurs make when pitching VCs is to kind of argue for the company, kind of the, what I would call the mean case, the average case of the outcome of the company that is a good company. When at least it's the sort of style of VCs we deal with, really want to hear about the upside case. They want to hear about the possibility of the company being a $1 billion company. And so, you know, I find that that you know, I sort of call it pitching the upside, not the mean. Is one of the most common mistakes that sort of entrepreneurs that aren't experienced pitching will make. I think another thing is just sort of how do you manage the process of, you know, having multiple firms involved, keeping them all along a certain timeline, you know, making sure that you're able to get a decent market price without sort of the combination of price discovery, without limiting your possible valuations. Again, remember, because we only do the seed round, we really want to see the just as the entrepreneurs, we want to see them get sort of a higher valuation. I find that Series A financing, where we help out, they tend to it tends to be a strange market where things rarely, I would say, companies rarely get properly priced. What happens is, and it really just depends on kind of the art of how they finesse the process, the entrepreneur finesses the process. It tends to always, it seems to me, to be over or underpriced. It sort of falls one way or the other. And this, I think, has to do with, is a function partly of the way, the fact that these are relatively small communities of investors who constantly talk to each other. And so, you know, a deal becomes quote unquote hot or it doesn't. And if it becomes hot, then they're all sort of chattering about it. You start to see a whole bunch of people get interested and the thing gets bid up, and the next thing you know, it gets funded at a high price and it's oversubscribed. And conversely, if a company's been out, kind of, you know, talking to VCs for a while and for whatever reason, and I personally find this is like the top two companies, which I think are equally, of equal quality, and simply because of, the nuances of how they manage the process, will have dramatically different outcomes on their Series A financings. We spend a lot of time trying to help people think through milestones. So the way I kind of think about the process is when we seed invest, we think about how are we going to make sure this company gets to the next milestone. And, you know, in some cases that can be to be profitable. And that's happened with, you know, I'd say, you know, 10 to 20% of our companies have gotten profitable in the seed stage financing. But in most cases it means raising more money. And I think the biggest mistake that, that companies make is sort of hitting what I would say half a milestone, sort of building a product, let's say, in a market where, let's say, if you're doing consumer internet, you really need not just a product, but you need to show, you know, you need to show that there's real traction amongst users. If you're building enterprise software, you probably need to show, you know, some interest from two or three large customers. If you're building a really hard, you know, like a hardcore technology product, you probably, maybe in that case, only need to build a product. it's often very hard for, especially a first-time entrepreneur, to know how VCs will perceive their company and their progress. And I think one thing that experienced seed investors can do is sort of help people think through those milestones. What will they need to do to, what will they need to accomplish in order to, you know, make their company worth more? And how much money do they need to raise to do that? And who do they have to hire to do that? And kind of working backwards, I guess, from thinking backwards from what would a successful Series A look like and working back to the seed stage and kind of thinking that through is something we spend a lot of time on. In terms of choosing investments, you know, we're sort of industry agnostic. We have a bunch of investments in hardware, a bunch of software, internet, B2B, B2C. We just made four investments in sort of education-related startups. We have two in the art market in New York. So sort of all over the place. It tend to be things that definitely leverage technology. I found actually now that I have enough data, sort of historical data that counter to what one might think, I think my worst investments have been the ones where I actually understood the market the best, which sounds very counterintuitive. I think the explanation is that in those cases, I sort of fell in love with the idea of sort of the product idea because I knew the market well, and I overlooked maybe the fact that the team was not a great team. And so it's really just, if I go back and look at kind of my track record, I found that virtually, you know, a direct correlation between the quality of the team and the outcome. And I, for me, as an entrepreneur, I sort of use as a heuristic the idea now that when I meet somebody, I ask myself, would I co-found a company with this person? And which for me is sort of a sort of understandable, kind of intuitive way to kind of think about it. And if the answer is yes, then I'm probably inclined, you know, given good terms, you know, reasonable terms and an interesting market to invest. And if the answer is no, I don't. And that's sort of really become my driving heuristic for making investment decisions. I feel that though to do that requires more than kind of I think there's something broken in the process of sort of having a one-hour meeting, maybe then you have a few follow-up meetings, and trying to really get to know someone like that. And so I've spent a lot of time thinking about better ways, you know, because when you're really in a super early stage investing, you're really in the talent business, and I spend a lot of time thinking about how I can better sort of evaluate talent. I just don't think that sort of particularly the situation of sort of sitting in a room where someone has a PowerPoint and they're kind of selling you on their idea I feel it's a very unnatural context in which to evaluate somebody. And so instead, I try to do things like kind of sit and work with them. And see how they actually work in a day-to-day, you know, through the day-to-day process. I remember I have one friend who invested in a company, and it looked great. It seemed like a great entrepreneur, and they were really excited. And then the company made no progress, and a year into it, my friend who was the investor went and sat in with the entrepreneur for like 2 days, and he said to me afterwards, he realized that the entrepreneur's only skill in life was pitching investors, which I think is a in this business. Because I think there are people that are good at doing that, and I'm not sure in some businesses if it's a super sales heavy business that doesn't correspond to kind of their entrepreneurial skills. But in many cases, it's really just not a good way to measure people. So I spent a lot of time thinking about that, and I don't think it's the right answer for that yet. I think I'm always sort of experimenting with new ways to kind of evaluate talent, because that's really what we're doing at this stage. What else can I say? I don't know, Michael, should I take any questions right now so far? Are there any questions so far? Or?
Yeah, Yeah, we can definitely do that. If anyone would like to go ahead and ask a question right now, go ahead and hit star 6 on your phone to unmute your mic. Just announce yourself and ask the question, and then after you're done, just please hit star 6 again to make sure that you mute the mic so that the background noise doesn't become too overwhelming. Does anyone have any questions? Also, Chris, there were some submitted in advance, which I can spout one out.
I just want to make sure this is interesting and relevant to people so far. So.
Okay, very good. All right. Let me. Do you want me to ask any? Do you want me to ask some of the questions that were submitted up front, or just continue on?
Okay. Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be a great way to kind of, and I can then just elaborate.
Okay. One of the questions submitted was: when the companies you back are ready for follow-on financing, their Series A or next round, can you talk about trends? Is that A round harder or easier to get done now, do you think? And you know, how aggressive are the venture firms in preserving or degrading your position as an angel?
It's funny you ask that because I was debating people that on Twitter last night. Actually, the New York Times, as we speak, just published an article about a little debate I had with these other angels. There was an article in the Journal yesterday saying it had gotten much harder for people to raise Series A. I don't see that right now. I mean, maybe it's a selection bias in my portfolio, but the experience we have, it really varies by sector. So, for example, you know, if it's an interesting, you know, social media company right now, we find it's, and then they are making progress, we find it very easy to get a Series A on very good terms. I wouldn't say very easy, but it's not, there's not a cash crunch as the Wall Street Journal described it. You know, it is a good company. I think I've had a case of, like, some of my hardware investments where the companies I think are doing phenomenally well, have real revenues, going after a huge market, and because it's not kind of a trendy area, it's been harder. And I think that's one of the dangers that angels and seed investors have, is that because we don't have the capital to kind of fund a Series A, we're subject to the whims of kind of the trends of those investors, which in my opinion are not always rational. So I think that there will be, I think, you know, clearly, you know, there's stuff going on now in Northern California where people come out of Y Combinator and they're first-time entrepreneurs and you're seeing like $15 million valuations, and this stuff is just not sustainable. There's just no way that this can be that on average people can be investing at those prices unless, you know, there's a dramatic change in the M&A market and have that be sustainable. So I think there will be some kind of downturn, and I don't know when it'll be, now, you know, in 3 weeks from now to 3 years from now, but another thing we do is, and I think it's a really important thing for all angel investors to do, is to preserve a certain percentage of your kind of investment capital, your angel investment capital, for defensive purposes, I call it. I saw this having lived through the last downturn, where you'll see kind of all sorts of weird financings happen where that tend to reward deep pockets. So, you know, things that are like effectively zero valuation rounds, just to pay to play or whatever. You may still like a company and you may think it's artificially low price, but because you've kind of run out of your risk capital, you can't participate. And so, you know, I always think at least, let's say, 20%. So if you sort of think about, you know, an angel investor, I would sort of think about it as, I'm going to invest over, you know, if you've got $1 million to invest total, I think of it as like, I'm going to invest it over four or five years, and I'm going to preserve 30% or something of that. Also for defensive purposes, that's kind of how we think about it. So I personally am not seeing, it's weird. I mean, because the broader economy is obviously struggling, but there's this sort of bifurcated market where the venture world is still pretty enthusiastic. So that's the impression I get. But you know, obviously, I'm one data point.
Okay, very good. Another question that was submitted in front, and I think this kind of tails with some of your comments just a few minutes ago. The pricing, the A round, best practices on what to do and how to position the company to make it considered, you know, hot. And I think the expression you used, you know, creating lots of chatter to build the value.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's sort of. And by the way, if anyone's interested, I probably every thought I have here. I've written a blog post. If you go to cjason.org, I have literally dozens of blog posts about all of these things. If anyone's interested in following on with that, but So I think a couple of things. What I advise entrepreneurs that my best practice for raising any round, first, I think I tell them to come in their mind with a kind of a minimum valuation they'd be happy with, but never, frankly, say that number, because I don't think there's anything to be gained from saying it. It probably only sets a ceiling on the valuation. And I think I've seen a number of times where people go out, maybe they're too, or either there's a ceiling or scare people off, and, you know, sort of like, but even if you want to get 30 free for your next round, if you could tell people that, you probably won't get it because they'll get you scared off. If you don't say anything, you get five VCs interested and they end up bidding it to 30. That's how you get to 30, right? It's sort of the same thing as if you're selling something on eBay, you never start at the highest price. I find just not saying a price and just saying, here's my last round of post money was five. We think we've made progress. We'll see what the market will bear, and just sort of let the market figure that out. I think choosing the VCs to talk to is very important. This is where advisors and seed investors should be helpful. You can get bogged down talking to way too many. You know, usually a good company can talk to, I find if it's well-targeted, they can talk to maybe five or six VCs and get a pretty good sense of the market. And that saves them time and you know, obviously that's in a good case. I think acting quickly, I think once you've spoken to a single VC, even if you sort of say you're not really raising money, you probably have like a 2 months maybe before you start being perceived as kind of tired or something. And so you have to kind of go out and do it kind of all at once and do it quickly. I just say have kind of quote buy it now price. If the VC is someone you really like as a person, and by the way, I say that I always tell people that on a Series A, it really is a partnership, and you really just get to know the VC well. And it's really important that you trust and like him or her. And so I also think that one of the downsides of the current kind of frothy environment is people are making decisions about these things too quickly. But I think that you should always, if you find someone you really like, sort of offer kind of a preemptive price. So you don't say it's the price you're going for, but you say, I like you a lot, and if you want to preempt, I'm going to conduct a process right now, and I'm talking to a number of people, but because they like you so much, if you can do 23, I'll preempt the process, and we can just do it now. Otherwise, I want to finish the process. And that kind of gives you the flexibility to sort of end it then and sort of get it over with and move on, while also having some optionality around getting the price a little bit higher. The other trick is always setting the timelines, because you want to get people kind of to the term sheet stage at the same time. But you don't want to be too definite about it, because it's really kind of an art, because if you say I'm going to finish everything up next Friday and then you don't have term sheets on Friday, you look kind of like, damaged goods. But if you don't give it a timeline, then you sort of have one person come with a term sheet and someone else is like, well, I haven't done diligence yet. And so I sort of, you have to kind of do it, but in a vague way, but in a, sort of, I'm trying to wrap things up the next few weeks and try to get people kind of pushing along in the sort of, similar kind of ways, similar pace. I think that, I always advise that the earlier stage of your company, the more you should care about the quality of investors versus valuation. I really think, like, I had a number of cases recently where, because we had a great VC invest, or if we wanted to invest, we probably, me and the entrepreneur, that was, me as an investor and the entrepreneur, when we talked about it, probably took a, 30-40% discount valuation to get a top VC. I think that is reasonable to do when it's an very early stage company. I think, once you're getting to Series C and D, it's probably much more of a financial decision. I think, timing is so critical on these things. I know a lot of companies now I talk to who are saying, well, in 6 months we'll have made so much more progress. Maybe we should wait to raise money. And my advice to them is no, do it now, because macro forces are very positive right now, and I can only imagine them getting worse, and that will dominate as much progress as someone makes, if the market deteriorates rapidly, that will more than make up for the progress they made. So that's just like a few of the points I think I like to think about.
Okay, very good. There's another question here that was submitted that's kind of related to your comment just a few minutes ago on the frothy environment, especially in Silicon Valley to some degree. Accelerated angel decisions, especially in key angel heavy markets like Silicon Valley, Boston, New York, are they leading to worse decisions? And have you noticed a trend? And how have you dealt with those compressed times in which us angels have to make those decisions?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bad trend, and I think it's bad both for entrepreneurs and for angels, because I just simply think, it's more than simply a financial transaction, these kinds of investments. It's really a partnership, and it sounds kind of corny, but it is, and you might just find you're dealing with people you don't want to deal with, so I think it's an unfortunate byproduct of the frothy environment, and I mean, frankly, I just deal with it by not participating in it. By if we're not given time to get to know somebody, we don't invest. We probably miss opportunities because of that. But I think I think you have to kind of stay disciplined. And if you, and like in our case, we're kind of talent investors, and if we don't have time to get to know the talent, we just can't do it. But yeah, I think it's definitely I think it's a byproduct of the frothy environment, and I expect it'll change. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people get stuck with investors and investments that they don't like as a result. I see it mostly in California, Northern California, Silicon Valley. It's lesser than New York and Boston. I think other places, but really, because it's really particularly Silicon Valley right now. And the prices there are probably twice as high on these stage deals, I think.
And by the way, if anyone would like to ask a live question, again, just hit star 6 and just don't wait to be prompted. Just jump in and ask
your question. Michael, it's Mike Petridis with the Investment Forum in Dallas. I was just going to ask a question about deal structure, whether it's convertible debt, preferred, common, mm-hmm. warrants.
Sure. I think my favorite is what I would call the kind of classic equity with preferred shares, not common. 1x straight, non-participating preferred. I think is sort of what I typically see these days. No, typically no warrants. There is a trend towards convertible notes. We won't do them unless they have a cap, right? So a pure convertible note is a loan, and you might as well be a bank. That and it's like this doesn't make sense from a risk reward point of view. When you add a cap to it, just to clarify, like a cap meaning like the $5 million cap, which means that if the company is if you put in $100,000 in $5 million cap, and then the next round 30 pre, your $100,000 becomes $600,000 in the next round, right? Because six times as much. I prefer equity rounds. With a convertible cap, we accept because that's the market. And the way I think of it is, a cap gives you economic rights, meaning you make money if the company goes up in value, without control rights. You're not a shareholder. You don't board seats. You don't, have all the different things that the shareholder right, minority rights that you have under law and things. I guess I find that in these really early stage deals, the control rights probably don't matter that much, because if you're going to be getting in a big fight with your two-person startup, it's probably going to be a disaster anyways, because you're kind of investing in people. I think we sort of begrudgingly accept convertible notes. And there's one good thing about convertible notes, which is they tend to cost less from the companies and the investment side. When you have these smaller rounds, like, in New York, you see these equity rounds, and sometimes they'll cost $20,000 for both, $20,000 on the company side and on the investment side, and that's just ridiculous on like a small round, like a huge percentage of it. There's a move to standardize a lot of the equity documents, which I think is a good thing, but I haven't seen it. There always seems to be some special situation about a company that the lawyers manage to come up with some reason why the bill is higher. I don't know. So. Is that helpful, or do you want me to talk more about structure?
Yeah, he might have already muted his mic.
Thank you so much.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Any other questions? If anyone would like to ask a live question, go right ahead. Chris, I probably should have sent many of these other questions they submitted to me right before the beginning of this thing to you to prepare, but that would make it too easy on you. Any other live questions? All right, I've actually got one myself, and that is, what other experiments have you done to better evaluate the talent of the founders? You mentioned sitting and working with them before investing. That's a great tip. You mentioned that you've done a number of other experiments and tried other ways. What other ways have you tried? What other ways do you think are good indicators?
Yeah, so for example, I have extra office space here in New York, and we actually let a bunch of random, very small startups hang out here, like six of them, and that's led to maybe two investments, I guess. And so, things like that, like for example, where we like them, there's good energy, we have extra space, you just kind of get to know them, and there's no promise of any kind of, or expectation, of any kind of investment. I think the other thing is that the way we structured our fund is that we have kind of seven key people who are entrepreneurs, but only two of whom are full time, so the other five are just kind of out there, doing their thing, and they get to know a lot of our best deals come in through those people, because they'll say, hey, this is some person I've known, for 5 years, and is one of my favorite entrepreneurs, and that's a really important kind of way. So I think and then also we have a number of entrepreneurs who put sort of a significant amount of money into our fund and see our fund as their primary angel investment vehicle. And those people work for us as people. And I think those people are like so close to us that we feel like, an endorsement from them saying, I've known this person for 5 years and they're the best entrepreneur I know, is trustworthy enough that we're able to really kind of weigh that heavily. So I think that's another way to sort of by kind of having a kind of a federated structure with a bunch of people that we trust deeply lets us kind of expand our footprint and kind of have more faith in making investments in people that some member of our sort of federated group knows.
Another question that was submitted, your thoughts on what is the right amount of seed money? Are the founders usually asking for the right amount? And maybe you can talk about, how you go about proper sizing it with them?
Yeah, I think this is sort of what I sort of briefly alluded to before, which is this idea of kind of working backwards from thinking about the key milestones. So, you're building a security software company that you're going to sell to Fortune 500 companies. I go out personally and talk to a bunch of VCs, I just do this generally. I kind of know what they kind of see as like an attractive Series A security company. And then in that case, let's say if you're selling Fortune 500 companies, they're going to want to see a couple of those Fortune 500 companies using that software. Right? So we kind of know that's kind of what we've got to do. And then we work backwards through an operational plan and kind of figure out, right, how long is it going to take to build it? What's the sales cycle going to be? And that should really be, and then add 50% because everything takes cost more and takes longer than you think. So you always have that buffer. But that's how ideally you do it. What I find that what ends up happening in real life is that, deal dynamics often, end up changing the amount raised. So, someone else will have a thing put together where we said this person needs $1 million, and then some other really good investor will come in and say they want to put in $200,000, and then next thing you know, everyone's like, well, that person's really strategic and will help a lot, and so we better make room for them. And the next thing you know, it's $1.5 million or $1 million, and so you end up being driven more by deal dynamics than operational need, which is unfortunate, but I find that in practice what often happens.
Very good. Another question here. Any predictions on the next hot sectors and industries Angel should be cognizant about?
I can say that, like, for example, consumer internet is way overly heavily invested in, especially in, like, areas like Silicon Valley and New York. And I don't feel, with a few notable exceptions of just really outstanding people, I think I'm personally shying away from that. I think that people talk about it's fundamentally the idea that people go to, you know, they go to work at a large corporation and they use, you know, I don't know what, like just sort of heavy installed software that was kind of designed a decade ago. And they come home and they use an iPad and Gmail and these other Facebook, whatever. And I think you just fundamentally had this problem where, you know, the IT departments were choosing software for the business people. And I think now with, you know, with kind of SaaS/cloud-based services, and you can deliver software much more cheaply. You've seen a lot of companies have success kind of with what I would describe kind of a bottom-up versus top-down approach to sales. So, you know, a good example, a company MySQL, database company, they sort of, what happened there was developers started sort of using it throughout big companies for, like, little side projects, and next thing you know, half the company's using it, and the CTO says, wait, half the company's using this software, what is this stuff? We better go figure it out, and there's a company, MySQL, that was a beneficiary of that because they would provide support and services around it. And so instead of sort of the historical pattern of selling the enterprise where, you know, you go to the CTO, CIO, and pitch them and go through the IT department and then install heavy software, you see this kind of interesting thing where things kind of bubble up. And I think what that does is it dramatically lowers the cost of sales, potentially dramatically lowers the cost of sales, and lets the users of the software also be the decision makers, which I think will lead to much higher quality software. So I think that's sort of interesting. I personally like things like that are just sort of, I mean, I think to have really good investments, you have to be somewhat contrarian. So, you know, I've made two robot investments, for example, and like other things that are sort of out of fashion. You know, I think, for example, we invested in a company in Boston called Harvest Automation, which makes agricultural robots. It's a $45 billion market, and, you know, it's sort of just not a sector that the VCs are looking at, and I think it's a really interesting company, and provides a like, very clear value to its customers. I think, what else do I like? I think, like I mentioned, five of my recent investments were in education. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff around there. I think I think most people agree we have a lot of problems in our educational system. And it's a very hard market to penetrate, particularly K-12, because you have, you know, controlled by the government effectively. But in the college level, at least, I think there's a lot of room for innovation, and so we've done a lot there. I'd love to do more in sectors like finance and energy. They tend to be really hard. In energy, it tends to be really hard to find ways to do it capital efficiently. Most of the things there are just, you know, whatever, some giant solar plant or something that just requires $100 million and they don't have it. Or in finance, in like Wall Street, tends to be such a heavily regulated industry, I think it's a very hard market for startups to penetrate. But I have a very simplistic view of the world, which is, particularly the internet, I guess, which is I think that the internet will probably eventually transform every industry, and anyone that hasn't transformed it will. And I kind of look around and say, what is not transformed yet? And you know, and then if I find a great entrepreneur working on a problem there, I'd be excited about it.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Yeah, my name is Bob Schmidt from Cleveland, Ohio, and I'm both an angel and an entrepreneur, and this is from the entrepreneur's side, my question. We've got a medical device company that we've launched a product in Europe, still awaiting for FDA, and we're trying to raise the $3 to $5 million kind of dead zone area of too big for angel, too small for VC. I'm just wondering if you have any comments on that or suggestions of, you know, what do you do in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, are you talking to VCs on the East and West Coast or whatever? Particularly like with your, you know, the kind of medical stuff, there's like a set of VCs in Boston and California which tend to do that more. I don't know, is that the people you talk to? Or?
Well, we talked to a few of them, and, you know, like, this is the first time we've ever raised money. We've been in business for almost a decade, and we've launched the product, so we've, you know, got $15 million into this thing. And so now for the first time we're trying to go out and get institutional money, and so it's too small for all the VCs that we've talked to. And you know, from the angel side, if it's got a valuation of more than $5 million, it's just, you know, it can't be done.
I think, for example, two of my companies just got funded at Series A for $3 million. That tends to be on the low side, I agree. But five is pretty much in the range of a lot of these Series A. I mean, it may be that you're not talking to the right people, or it may just be that they think, you know, because you have the FDA process and whatever, I mean, medical just stuff in general tends to be more capital intensive, and maybe that they just feel like it's going to take more than five. And the reality is that oftentimes you end up with VCs taking more money than you want to and taking more dilution than you want to, because their model is to, you know, if they're a $800 million fund and they have eight partners, you know, each partner has to deploy $100 million, and they want to, you know, like when I was a Bessemer, their model was to put $10 million into each company. And it's sort of, it's not really driven by the company's needs, it's driven by their kind of, their business model. And so the reality is, you know, maybe you make up for the higher valuation, but the reality is you may end up taking more money than you need because of the business models of the VCs. And, you know, in my experience, it may not be, I mean, you can get the valuation to a reasonable point where it's not like painful dilution. It may not be the worst thing in the world, having an electric cash in the bank. But, I mean, it's unfortunate, but I think a lot of times the amount raised is driven by the needs of the VCs and not the company.
Hey, Chris, and I'm sorry, the caller from Cleveland, we just need to keep it on topic if we can, and we've discussed this before. Chris, changing the topic, because seed funds are rarely, if ever, large enough to build a brand, almost every plan we see has SEO as a key marketing strategy. Can you talk about the sustainability of that, and is that shoe getting thin at this point?
SEO is search engine marketing? Search engine optimization? Yeah, I mean, I think so I actually wrote a blog post on this and got, like, just trashed by the whole SEO community or something. But I think that, like, you know, I was investing in, like, 2003 or something, you know, you would see business plans that were, like, and basically, effectively, they were saying, you know, like TripAdvisor or sort of the famous examples of things like TripAdvisor where, you know, people are searching for travel recommendations and there's no good content provided. And so our plan is to provide that good content and then have it surface through, you know, Google. And it works great. I think what you're seeing now, and in fact, another example is Yelp was a company that rose basically through SEO. And, you know, the CEO of Yelp was recently testifying in front of Congress, and they asked him about, you know, they were testifying about Google's alleged anti-competitive practices. And they asked the CEO if he would start Yelp today, and he said no, he wouldn't, because now Google is sort of moving into so many different areas and supplying their own content for a lot of these things. You know, so you basically think of Google as a, and Google, by the way, I mean, despite what you see in reports, is really sort of 90% market share of search. But they're basically, it's a platform that's sort of vertically integrating into lots of different areas and supplying content. And I think the combination of that combined with the fact that there's just a huge industry of people out there who've been optimizing their content for SEO for years, that it just has become much, much harder for startups to break into it. So I think it's really, I'm investing in a company, Stack Overflow, which has done very well on SEO, but it's very focused programming-related, like computer programming-related content. I think there's certain exceptions like that. I think for the most part, like I've seen very few companies in the last 3 years get significant traction through SEO, and I think it's sort of the golden era of that is over.
Okay, very good. Another question that was submitted. Tech startup valuations are, as you've commented yourself, you know, very high in Silicon Valley especially. You know, if and when those valuations come back down to earth, will that have a significant effect in most other cities and put Angel out of favor for a while? And any predictions on how long, if that happens, and any predictions you have on that topic?
I think what we've had happen now is that, you know, you have these cycles where, you know, people made tons of money, let's say before on Google and now at Facebook, like as employees, and then they leave and they start investing as angel investors. And in New York here, it's sort of become like trendy to be an angel investor. And so it's people that like from hedge funds and real estate start angel investing. You see all these sorts of other kinds of people coming in. And they tend to not be, you know, they're not professional investors. And so they, you know, they're less disciplined about valuations and things as they push things up. And I, you know, and at least if history is any guide, this will turn back around and it'll become untrendy. And I'm frankly looking forward to it. And they'll go back to doing what they used to do, and people like me and maybe the listeners on the phone today will continue doing our thing. And yeah, so I expect that just across the board, a lot of this stuff is cross geography these days. I'm investing in California, vice versa over here. So I think these things get, you know, I think that they're certainly correlated to valuations in these various areas. And I think, I don't know when it's like famously in all markets, you know, we all knew the real estate market was overpriced in 2007. We just didn't know when it would correct itself. And I think it's similar here. I just, I don't know when it'll happen, but it needs to happen. And so, you know, I think that'll probably, my experience is that'll be it. When it does happen, it'll be a great time to invest. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Very good. And then one last, I think we've got time for one last question, and that question's actually one of mine. Personalizing the web and anticipating interest. You've done, you know, heavy thought leadership work on that at Hunch. Your thoughts and how far will that go?
Sorry, what part of the web?
The personalizing the web, anticipating interests, and all the interesting things that Hunch does.
Oh, thanks. So Hunch, what we do is we have a technology that does kind of provides recommendations for things. So the idea is sort of in a broader trend of, you know, the sort of explosion of information and on the web, and, you know, Google has done a good job helping to organize that, and a bunch of other people trying to, and we have sort of a different approach to it, which is we get to sort of really understand and learn about the user and try to find surface things that they would like. I think it's clearly a need. And whether or not we have the right approach to it is, I think, an open question. But clearly, you know, there's all these studies about the amount of information growing exponentially and just people being overwhelmed, sort of information overload. And there's, I think, all sorts of business opportunities around thinking about ways to help get through all of that information. So we have one way, which is sort of a heavy algorithmic way, and other people have other methods, for example, you know, more social methods, let's say. And I think probably there's room for a bunch of different solutions to be successful.
Very good. Well, I think that's about all the time we have. We've got about two more minutes of closing remarks. But, Chris, thank you so much for taking an hour to share your thoughts with so many angels today. Your involvement and dedication to entrepreneurism sets a high benchmark for others to follow. Thank you so much. Very good. Everyone on the call today may listen to past events and participate in future events at no charge. You may see a full listing of future events at angelpool.org. Again, that's angelpool, as in swimmingpool.org, and then clicking on the Knowledge tab. There are a number of high-profile speakers and panels coming up that will be discussing various aspects of angel investing best practices. Also, Reid Hoffman's talk on Internet Investing 2.0 is now available here at the site. On October 27th at 2 p.m., there will be a panel on future hot sectors, skating to where the puck will be. On December 1st at 2 p.m. Eastern, there will also be Om Malik, founder of GigaOM, talking about future tech trends and what is getting hot. There will be an ACA Southeastern Regional Conference meeting on October 19th, next week in Charlotte, North Carolina. It'll include sessions on valuations, innovations, syndications, and an update on the new ACA Halo reporting systems to help us better track national angel trends and deal terms. There'll be an ACA Northeast regional meeting on October 27th in New Haven, Connecticut. This event will feature syndication opportunities and a speaker in the first part of the day, followed by the Connecticut Innovation Pipelines Award. Angels may attend both events with their registration. The ACA Annual Summit will be held on March 6th through 8th in Austin, just before the famous South by Southwest Interactive Conference. There will also be pre-summit programming by the Angel Resource Institute. If anyone has not attended an ACA summit, they are exceptional in both contacts and content. I cannot say good enough things about the last one by MIT this year. This call was recorded and will be available by tomorrow at both angelpool.org and at angelcapitalassociation.org. A special thank you again to our speaker, Chris, for all the angels and angel groups that were able to join us across North America. We appreciate your participating. Hopefully this Angel Knowledge Series will be both useful in your efforts. The call is now concluded. Thank you all, and have a great day.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You are about to end this meeting. To end, press 1. You're the only person still in the meeting.